Alice Dreger's on the faculty of the Medical Humanities and Bioethics program of Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She is also the author of One of Us, Conjoined Twins and the Future of Normal. Conjoined twins are usually classified according to the point at which they are joined. Conjoined twinning usually happens when a small embryo starts to divide into identical twins but doesn't develop completely. Conjoined twins are quite rare, accounting for approximately 1 in 50,000 births. It's hard to know for sure, because sometimes conjoined twin births get reported as one birth and sometimes as two. Dreger told me about the twins from Iran.
Ladin and Lale Bajani, they were separated in 2003 by their request. They were 29 years old at the time, and they were joined essentially at the side of the head, kind of facing slightly away from each other so that they could not see each other's faces without the aid of a mirror or cameras. They were very unusual for conjoined twins, and by that I mean that they were the first people in history that we know of who actually requested separation surgery and decided to go through with it for themselves.
No, wait a minute. The first people in history who decided, because there have been many surgeries to separate people, all of them prior to that were against their will?
Decided by parents. And I was quite stunned by that as well. Coming to this as a person who was not born conjoined, I assumed that anybody who was conjoined would absolutely want to be separated, that this would be a totally intolerable state. You'd feel trapped all the time. But in fact, when I looked historically at what people who were conjoined said about themselves, wrote about themselves, and what people who knew them personally said, is that it actually wasn't at all like that, that many of them actually saw it as a special strength, as a special way of being in the world that actually made them better than other people, which really shocked me when I read that because I couldn't imagine that. But Ladin and Lale were the first people who really felt that this was absolutely a state they couldn't live with to the point where they were willing to risk their lives. Now, I've pointed out in the book I've published on this that, in fact, I think that they were given incorrect statistics going into it, that informed consent didn't really happen to the point of them being told the tremendous risk they were taking on. And, in fact, both of them died in the operation. But they were the first people in history to go through with it by their own accord.
Often this takes place, I guess, it provides some comfort to people, when the conjoined twins are very young. And so you would expect their parents to make the decision about that in the way that you'd expect their parents to make the decision about whether they needed corrective abdominal surgery. But still, to say that this is the first time that conjoined twins have consented to separation just makes you view the whole thing in an entirely different way, doesn't it?
I think that happens in part because many of these surgeries are easier to do when children are very young. And the notion is also that the psychological risk will be lower. If you can't remember it, there shouldn't be that much psychological damage from it. But the other thing that happens is the honest truth is as people grow who are conjoined, most people simply express no interest in being separated. So a lot of conjoined twins have said over time that they had absolutely no interest in being separated, that to them would be like cutting off an arm and having your arm go off and have a life of its own, that it'd be just much too bizarre. In fact, even little kids have said this sort of thing. There was two twins I talk about in the book, Ruth and Verena Katie, who died at the age of 7 from complications of their conjoinment. And they were joined very intimately. They shared a heart. And the two of them said to reporters who had asked them about their lives when they were about 5 years old was that it was like living in a perpetual hug, that they couldn't imagine having to go through the world where you didn't have somebody whose arm was around you all the time. And I thought that was very touching and very remarkable in terms of its insight.
Yeah. They say essentially that they feel like, am I saying this wrong? They feel like one person, or maybe they feel like this is the most natural way for them to live, which would be different from feeling like one person, because they are individuals, aren't they?
They are individuals, and quite consistently conjoined twins are adamant about that and will speak about themselves in the first person singular. They tend not to speak about we, except to the extent of if they're talking to somebody about both of them, then they'll use we. But they typically use their own first-person pronoun. They speak about themselves. They have individual lives in the sense that they develop often different friendships, so friends separate from each other. They have individual tastes. In fact, many conjoined twins may individuate, that is, become different from each other even more extremely than other kinds of identical twins do, specifically because they can't separate from each other. And so they develop quite distinct personalities and distinct lives in many ways.
So the real problem that we're talking about is a societal problem, isn't it? We can't handle their being conjoined.
I think that's right. And I also think that in that sense, we have to take it seriously. You know, when I was writing this book, I didn't come down on the side of, oh, separation should never happen. Because in fact, I did see how people who are conjoined had their lives quite dramatically limited by social assumptions. So, for example, marriage prohibitions have been very intense against conjoined twins, even when conjoined twins have had perfectly good reasons for wanting to marry and perfectly legal reasons to marry. That is, that they are individuals, that they have individual legal identities, but they've been prohibited over and over again from marrying. They have suffered terrible job discrimination. It's often the case that people feel that the discrimination that happens against them is justifiable because they're weird and they're abnormal. And so part of me thinks, well, if the social injustice is this intense, maybe we should think seriously about sending a child into the world conjoined. Because are they going to be able to survive that? On the other hand, as I've pointed out in other writing that I've done, you know, that was often the reaction to women historically and to people who were black, was that they were inferior, they were in an abnormal state, they were substandard. And the solution to that wasn't historically to change women into men through surgery, and it wasn't to try to change black people into white people through surgery. It was to change minds and not bodies.
What is the objection to marriage, for instance? Is it a recognition that there are two people and we don't allow two people to marry one other?
I think it's a tremendously inarticulate objection. And in fact, if you look historically, the objection is sort of like that. It's sort of an objection to group sex, but it's also kind of just an objection to the idea that anybody who's this different should be allowed to marry. And historically, again, we see laws that were used against all sorts of people with what we would now call disabilities or differences, laws that were used against people who were considered to be mentally incompetent that prohibited them from marrying, laws against people who are disabled against marrying. And we've seen also laws which are anti-same-sex marriage laws, which are essentially also anatomical restriction laws. They're laws that say, because of your body type, we will not allow you to marry the person that you love. Historically, there's been a lot of those kinds of prohibitions. And even age limit marriages are essentially anatomical limits. And they're not something that most of us object to. Most of us don't think five-year-olds should be allowed to legally marry. So what we're trying to do in this century that I think is a really big project we're going to have to undertake is figuring out what people's bodies are going to mean to their legal and social and political rights. It's been a hard question. Historically, what's happened is we've increasingly said, in our country at least, that your body's not going to limit your rights. It's not going to limit your privileges. It's not going to limit who you are. It's not going to limit your schooling, your right to marry. Historically speaking, that's the direction we've gone in. But we're still struggling with this question of, well, when should the body matter? When should we say that body's not okay in terms of this social context?
Historically speaking, conjoined twins have been allowed to marry. Eng and Cheng, the Siamese twins of an earlier generation, each married and had large families. They even lived separately, although, of course, the mind reels when you think about them living separately. They had to go back and forth to farms a mile apart.
On the other hand, who wants to be with their in-laws all the time, right?
Well, and you can imagine why the wives might like to maintain the separate households, especially since they both had double-digit children. Right?
They did. One set of family had 10 children, the other had 12. And in fact, I've had the privilege of going to the family reunion of the descendants, and it's hundreds and hundreds of people because they had so many descendants and so many of them survived, which was really unusual for the 19th century to have so many of your children survive. And what happened there was very interesting. As I got to know the family, I asked them about their history and what they knew about the family history. And what they told me was also really well documented from contemporary accounts. The objection that the bride's parents had to their daughters marrying Chang and Eng was not about conjoinment. It was about race. They did not like the idea of their white daughters marrying Chinese men. Chang and Eng were Chinese descent, and they lived in Thailand, so they were called Siamese, but they were, in fact, of Chinese descent. And the parents of Adelaide and Sally Yates, who were the women who married Chang and Eng, objected very strongly to the idea of racial intermixing. And so there, again, is one of those anatomical prohibitions that kicked up. In fact, Chang and Eng were very well respected in their community and continued to be so long after they married the wives.
Coming back to the issue of conjoinment and the way in which we treat that, some of this is a medical problem, isn't it, or medical interest. The way in which the medical world thinks about conjoinment is leaving out the individual in many ways.
Conjoinment definitely comes in most cases with medical complications, and so people sometimes share organs or they have inadequate organs for the amount of body mass that they have. So there are medical issues that frequently come with conjoinment, and obviously those need to be dealt with. But most separations happen not because it improves the likelihood that the person will be healthy or will survive longer. In fact, I was stunned to realize as I looked at the data that separation surgeries almost always leave you worse off physically. They almost always leave people damaged in ways that they were not damaged before in terms of their physical bodies. And the survival rate for most types of conjoinment is significantly better if you're left together. Now, that's not true in some cases where, for example, there's a very complicated kind of heart system that's really rare. But in most cases, separation surgery is not good for you medically. And I was sort of shocked to realize that. It's done because doctors feel a very beneficent sensation that what they want to do is free these children that they see as trapped. And what I've tried to say to them over and over again is look at historically what we know, because what we know does not support your assumption that this is an unlivable life and that everybody would rather be dead than be conjoined. That's just not true.
Of course, it's the way we look at it. We as individuals can't imagine living in constant contact with another individual, and therefore we believe that conjoined twins must desire to be separated.
I think that's right. And in that sense, we sort of make them our doppelgangers. We assume that they must be exactly like us. And what I've tried to do in the book I wrote about conjoined twins was to say we should do the opposite. We should say what's like us that is like them, not what would we reject about ourselves that we must reject in them. So we reject ideas of being attached to other people, and therefore we reject that. But let's instead think about the ways in which we are, in fact, all attached to other people.
Alice Dreger is the author of One of Us, Conjoined Twins, and the Future of Normal.